for Liberty Radio Network, Chaos Radio, Chaos 95.9, and antiwar.com. This is Antiwar Radio. All right, we're back. I'm Angela Keaton, and on the line today, this is a real treat for me because I don't get to do this very often, as I don't love to interview artists, writers, and other great thinkers who come at these things from a creative perspective. And today we might have the perfect match of someone's politics experience and artistic expression in best-selling author Barry Eisler. Barry, are you with us today?
I am. Nice to hear your voice, Angela.
Oh, well, so glad to have you here today. I have so many questions for you. But first, is Ben a good guy or a bad guy?
Ben Trevin, my black ops soldier. I would describe Ben as a bad guy who has some of the seeds of a possible good guy inside him.
Well, the seeds of a good guy, we'll talk a little bit about that and perhaps your experiences in bar brawls in the Philippines, but you've written several novels, and you've had spy thrillers, I guess would be a fair case. There's spy novels and thrillers, but you're coming at this from some real experience. I mean, you've been a lawyer, a startup executive. You've done many, many things with your life, but one of your most interesting jobs, or at least to us anyway, to outsiders, was your early appointment to a certain government agency. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I spent 3 years in a covert position in the CIA from 1989 to 1992. And it was a very interesting experience, and certainly an invaluable experience for a guy who later on turned out to be a thriller writer.
Did you know? I mean, when did the bug hit you that you knew you wanted to express yourself this way?
You mean as a covert officer of the CIA or as a novelist?
as a novelist, I'm not really sure if I want to deeply delve into what made you want to be in the CIA.
I've always been writing something or other since I was a kid, and I think it's fair to say I seem to have exhibited a talent for writing from an early age, and it's almost embarrassing in retrospect to acknowledge that I had a talent for writing, and I always thought it would be a great way to make a living if you could write novels, and that would be a really cool thing to do. And it wasn't until I was 29 or 30 and living in Tokyo for the first time that I got an idea for a story that I started playing with, and at some point I realized, as it got more complicated, wow, this could really become a novel. I mean, I don't know why it took me so long to put together two obviously related thoughts. You're pretty good at something. You think it would be good to make a living doing that thing. Have you actually tried to do that? But I'm glad that, better late than never, I'm glad that I finally managed it.
Well, you've actually had quite a bit of success, and you're actually on now your second series with a new character. That was the Ben referring to earlier.
Right.
You had an even darker character in your earlier series. But, I mean, and I know everyone probably asks this. I mean, how much of this is just, I mean, not just based on your own experience, but based on kind of your political sensibilities?
That's an interesting question. I think I do tend to write these really dark characters. I mean, my first series character, John Rain, is he's an assassin. He's a contract killer. He's not formally affiliated with any state organization. Ben, at least, is a member of the U.S. military. So I tend to write these dark, cynical characters, and so people often expect me to be a dark, cynical person, which I don't think I am. Although clearly, I have some dark, cynical threads inside me. I think what any novelist does, whether it's with characters or politics or themes or whatever, is you recognize something in yourself and you try to tease that thing out, almost distill it out, and then reculture it in the personality of this new character you've created, where it takes on a new form. So I don't think you could create a character, for example, from nothing, if you didn't recognize some element of that character's humanity in yourself. I don't know how you could do it. But that's not to say that the character is in some way a duplicate or a clone of you. It's more an element that expresses itself a different way because it's now been cultured in a new medium. So a lot of times, politically, for example, when Ben, who tends to have a bit of a, what I would describe as a rightist worldview, which is not at all like my worldview, but I understand where he's coming from because I have those elements inside myself. I just culture them differently inside Ben. People sometimes mix my character's politics up with my own. I guess that's understandable.
Well, Inside Out, your most recent novel, I mean, this is very much a product of you know, understanding the news cycle about torture and black ops and the things that the government, the USG does that we aren't so proud of.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I guess the standard way to write a thriller today would be to have some sort of Islamic terrorism as the threat. And I'm of the opinion that we're much more of a threat to ourselves than Islamic terrorism is a threat. In other words, our response to the perceived threat of Islamic terrorism is much more of a problem for us than the perceived threat itself. So as a thriller writer, I want to, as realistically as possible, portray what I consider to be the most dangerous, the thing that's most dangerous to American democracy. And that takes me in a direction where I'm describing, where I'm focusing much more on the tactics and mindset that have led to Abu Ghraib, an embrace of torture, warrantless wiretapping, and things like that, imprisonment of Americans without charge, trial, or conviction, and now even Obama says that he has the power to have American citizens extrajudicially killed. These are astonishing things if you believe in the Constitution and democracy, and even more astonishing is the fact that the citizenry pretty much just accepts them. There's no, I don't want to say there's no outcry, there obviously is in certain quarters, but by and large people just accept these things as necessary consequences of our war against our war against Islamic terrorism. And these, to me, these behaviors, these policies are the real threat to American democracy.
You did let, I guess, maybe a tad bit of cynicism there. Perhaps it's idealism in what it is you expect from an American democracy, or at least our Constitution.
Yeah, that's you're right. So I look in the mirror and see an optimist, and then I open my mouth, and out comes a cynic. But I'll tell you, it's hard not to be cynical. What are we, almost 2 years in, a year and a half into the Obama administration? I mean, he, as a former constitutional professor, this is a guy who I thought, based on his experience, based on his explicit promises and in his rhetoric, really had an understanding of the value of the Constitution as the bedrock of American democracy. And he's gone actually beyond what the Bush administration did in several critical areas, including, again, his claimed right to be able to assassinate American citizens. Not even Bush did that in public. So it is a little hard to be cynical right now. Maybe I was naive at the time, but I thought during the Bush years that what we were experiencing was the radicalism of a bunch of neocons. And with Obama elected, I expected that the country was going to go at least some direction in some way in the direction of normal constitutional status quo, but we didn't have that.
All right, Barry, we'll be back in just a moment with Barry Eisler, the author of Inside Out, and this is Anti-War Radio.
You can interact with other LRN listeners at our message board at forum.libertyradionetwork.com. That's forum.libertyradionetwork.com.
I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't find a way out of here, I'm gonna go to
the... All right. We're back. This is the Liberty, this is Anti-War Radio, Liberty Radio Network, Chaos 95.9, and antiwar.com. I'm Angela Keaton, and on the line today we have best-selling author Barry Eisler. He's the author of Fault Line and Inside Out, which is just on shelves now, I believe. Right, Barry?
From today.
Oh, okay. I'm
sorry. You're one of the lucky ones who got a, sneak peek.
All right. Well, it's going to be, I mean, I'm sure the comparisons are going to be obvious, and people probably say these things to you all the time, but, you know, Tom Clancy has a definite political bent.
Yeah.
And it's hard to avoid that. I don't know how that's affected his sales. He certainly sells well, and where his books are in terms of popular culture. But is it fair to, I mean, given especially who your characters are named after and the kind of people who seem to enjoy your book, that you're a bit of a man of the left, perhaps?
Yeah, you know, I guess I am. Oh, it's funny. For a long time, I have resisted the label because most of the political nomenclature in America has gotten so bent and distorted that it doesn't really mean very much anymore. I'll tell you this. I used to think of myself as a Republican. Well, not as a Republican, sorry. More as a conservative, because I believe in small government. But to me, small government means, for example, a small military. I mean, you can't be for small government and want to have something like 800 or 1,000 military bases overseas. We don't know the exact number because it's secret. And you can't want to have a $1 trillion a year military budget and 1.5 million men under arms. I mean, you can't want those things and also call yourself small government. So I considered myself a real small government person, and I thought that meant that you were a conservative. But apparently it means something else. So at this point, as someone who believes in the Constitution, who believes in limited governmental power, who believes that war is the most caustic and destructive thing that a democracy can ever run up against, I apparently have become a man of the left. It's odd that those things now define people as leftists, but in America today, apparently they do.
Yeah, and I'm just not so hung up on labels, but I mean, when you're an artist such as yourself, I mean, people are going to pick up, I think, maybe certainly from inside out, a sense that you don't approve of just pointless violence.
Well, no, I don't, and I don't, and there's, you know, the truth is there's not that much violence that's really pointless. I think it sometimes seems pointless. So people say senseless violence is the catchphrase you come across typically, but if you really look at it, you'll realize there was a reason. It's just that the reason doesn't usually justify it in my mind. And, well, torture would be a great example. I mean, it's become almost a politically defining thing. If you can find ways to excuse or otherwise support torture, then you're probably, some sort of rightist, I would say. I would say actually authoritarian would be the more accurate terminology, but that's not a label anybody wants to cop to, so they call themselves conservatives. And if you're against torture, then instead of being a constitutionalist, you're more someone on the left. But yeah, these forms of violence, although they are done for a reason, I mean, unless even the sadist, I guess, is torturing for a reason to gratify a sadism, the reasons, in my opinion, do not justify the damage to national security or to our system of laws.
Talking about torture defining, I guess because I miss certain political cues, and maybe because I'm just in such a narrow area. But the Tea Party, for example, ran a candidate named Scott Brown, and he was ran GOP, and he eventually replaced that seat that Ted Kennedy once held.
Right.
And it seemed, though, that his campaign could be parodied as, "We don't torture people enough."
Yeah, it was the Mitt Romney, "I'll double Guantanamo" response. You know what characterizes the right today, and it's so interesting to me. If you boil it down, it's a kind of "if it feels good, do it" mentality. I mean, torture is largely an emotional response. It's certainly not a rational one because it costs you. Your claimed objectives of torture are not only not achieved, you wind up achieving the opposite. So torture makes no rational sense. It can make emotional sense the way revenge can make emotional sense. So people who support torture, whether they realize it or not, are largely doing it out of a philosophy of "if it feels good, do it," which is a slogan that used to be associated with the left and is now a rallying cry, an unconscious rallying cry of the right. So I have to say, I don't get the Tea Partiers. I mean, if you're an American today and you're not angry, you're not paying attention. It's the things that they're angry about. It's the way the anger expresses itself. Big government is a great case. The line that they draw in the sand on big government is health care for everyone, which we could debate. We could talk about the merits. But if you say, "I hate big government, and therefore we can't have health care for everyone," but you're giving a pass to 1.5 million man military with 800 to 1,000 overseas bases, something's wrong. You're not anti-big government. You're something else. If you were anti-big government, you'd have to want to trim the military. So I don't really understand the Tea Party. I understand their anger. I think you should be angry about what's going on in America today. It's the things that the anger attaches to that are curious to me.
That's a perfect summary of a lot of what some of us are thinking about the Tea Party, too. We certainly appreciate what it is that they're doing. The whys, though, are somewhat confusing. And I guess, what is it about torture that seems to be okay that speaks to people in, let's say, 2010 in,
yeah,
you know, in what's supposed to be the most civilized Western country of all of human history, that,
yeah,
that's still okay, and there's nothing weird or wrong about it.
Well, this is, you know, this is where it's interesting to be both political and a novelist, because I get to explore some of these issues through my characters. I'll say this: to me, civilization is mostly a veneer. I mean, it's a very important veneer. We should be doing everything we can to strengthen it and to advance it, obviously. But human nature itself has not changed since the time when we came down from trees. We're wired the way we're wired, and civilization hasn't changed that. It's changed our behavior, but it hasn't changed our nature. So in the face of extreme stress, all organisms tend to revert to some sort of default setting. Under the stress of 9/11, unfortunately, Americans reverted to a much more primitive setting that has to do more with our nature than it does with our, than it has to do with our rational minds and with civilization. And that setting has a lot to do with revenge and savagery than it does with sensible policies rationally designed to achieve policy goals.
You know, thinking about your express yourself in fiction, I'm wondering how much of Barack Obama, the expectations surrounding Barack Obama, were people's projection of looking for a perfect, handsome hero that was going to save them from all these dark, complicated questions about U.S. foreign policy,
right,
or any of these things that they don't want to grapple with?
That's a great question. I have to say everybody's influenced to some extent by the packaging, right? I mean, no matter whether it's a political candidate or a tube of toothpaste, we're influenced by packaging. And Obama came in a package, I think, that was nicely designed to appeal to people with liberal sensibility. And I was probably taken in to some extent by that, too. Although, in my own defense, in defense of anyone who was taken in, he certainly substantively said all the right things. I mean, right up until June 2008, when he betrayed his explicit promises to filibuster any bill that came before him. He's still a senator at the time. To filibuster any bill that came before him that gave immunity to law-breaking telecoms. He was saying all the right things up until the point when he not only didn't filibuster that bill, but he voted for it. And that's when I realized, wow, this guy is not what he's claimed to be. Not just what he seems to be or appears to be, but what he's explicitly claimed to be through his promised policies. So I can't really explain Obama's about-face. I've never seen anything like it. On the other hand, I'm not a historian. Probably one of the best explanations I've come across was in the New York Review of Books a few months ago. It was an excerpt from an excellent book, which I just finished, Bomb Power by Gary Wills. I highly recommend it. It's a short, superb book. Anyway, it was an excerpt from Gary Wills' book, and he talked about the way the whole national security infrastructure essentially swallows up a president, even perhaps a well-intentioned president. I don't know what Obama's intentions were or what they are. I can't read his mind. But on the assumption that he meant some of the things he said when he was campaigning, Wills offers one possible explanation for how he's been suborned.
Well, we only have about a minute left here, Barry. If you could tell us... Oh, okay, 30 seconds. Just tell us where people can find out more about you, and where your next appearance will be.
www.barryeisler.com, BarryEisler.com has as much information as anyone could need. And the new book, Inside Out, comes out on June 29th, all about the war on terror, the missing CIA interrogation case, and everything we've been talking about.
All right, thank you so much. That was Barry Eisler, and this is Anti-War Radio.